What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off.
Everett Cook co-founded Roe Business Banking to fundamentally change the way businesses manage their finances. He also previously spent time as a macro hedge fund trader. In this conversation, we discuss the rise of fintechs, how Roe has navigated the pandemic, why they focus on high growth businesses, and what Everett is able to apply to entrepreneurship from his macro trading days. I really enjoyed this conversation with Everett, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is OKCoin. There are a lot of crypto exchanges for us to choose from. Whether you're new to crypto, an advanced trader, or an institution, the most important thing when choosing an exchange is typically how easy it is to fund your account and the cryptos you can access through it. I always recommend people to have an account on a regulated exchange so you can easily go in and out of the market using your bank account. Recently, we have seen large regulated exchanges hike up trading and withdrawal fees. That's not cool. OKCoin is a US-based regulated exchange that serves 184 countries and is super easy to use and offers some of the lowest fees in the industry. What I love about OKCoin as an individual, I can go from registering to verifying my profile and connecting my bank account in minutes. In fact, OKCoin is literally the fastest exchange to go from zero to having a crypto portfolio. You don't have to wait 3 days for your deposit to show up or upload multiple ID documents or facial scans to get started, which by the way is a little creepy. They've also been listing popular DeFi assets, and I hear they're working on even more popular listings. You can go open an account at okcoin.com/pomp. Again, okcoin.com/pomp. Go check it out and let me know what you think at okcoin.com/pomp. Next up is CoinStats. If you own crypto in a lot of places, like me, you know how difficult it can be to keep track of it all. That's why CoinStats is one of my favorite apps. Whether you keep your crypto on hardware wallets, mobile wallets, exchanges, liquidity pools, or somewhere else, CoinStats lets you track it all in one place on your iPhone, Android, Apple Watch, or computer. You can see all of your transactions and your profit loss history and get advanced analytics on your portfolio's performance. Try it for free or go to coinstats.app/pomp and you'll get 40% off their premium subscription. So you can either use it for free or you can get the premium features at 40% off at coinstats.app/pomp or click on the link in the description. If you own Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in a lot of places, you need something to help you keep track of it all. CoinStats is by far the best solution. Go try it for free at coinstats.app/pomp. Lastly is Masterworks. The Fed has committed to keeping interest rates low for the foreseeable future. That means that bond yields, already at record lows, will continue to stay near 0%. With the stock market trading at record highs, sophisticated investors are taking some chips off the table. So where should you put your hard-earned wealth? Well, according to a new report from Citi Private Bank, contemporary art returned 13.6% per year over the last 25 years. Compare that to 8.9% per year for the S&P 500. Contemporary art, 13.6 per year. The S&P 500, 8.9% per year. Over the same time, contemporary art also had a lower loss rate than gold, with almost no correlation to the stock market. Masterworks.io, the sponsor, Masterworks.io, is the first and only platform that lets you invest in blue chip art from artists like Monet and Basquiat. Recently, Masterworks.io sold their first Banksy masterpiece for a 32% return net of fees to investors. If you're looking to diversify a part of your portfolio into a hard money alternative asset, check out Masterworks.io. To learn more, head to Masterworks.io and use promo code POMP to skip the 15,000 person waitlist. Again, Masterworks.io using the promo code POMP. Someday, I'll actually be able to say Basquiat, Basquiat, whatever it is, correctly. But go to Masterworks.io in the meantime, use promo code POMP, and go buy a Basquiat, a Basquiat, whatever it is. Masterworks.io, use promo code POMP. All right, let's get into this episode with Everett. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got a very special treat for you today. I've got Everett here with me. Thank you so much for doing this, sir. So let's jump into this and tell us kind of your background. How did you get into the finance world? And then we'll get into building Row.
Yeah, totally. So I started out when I was in college. I was really interested in markets. I started a couple companies when I was younger and then started trading stocks and loved like that world. Left college, went into investment banking. I didn't really know what, you know, the difference between investment banking or trading or, you know, anything was, but this, it was on Wall Street, literally. It was, I went to Deutsche Bank and spent about 2 years there doing doing investment banking. During that period, I started in 2007. I left in 2009. During that period, like the great financial crisis happened. And what was like really interesting to me, or what was like really sort of surprising to me, was how few people, you know, understood what was happening even while it was happening, even inside, you know, one of the largest investment banks in the world. And at that point, I got really interested in global macro, and I started reading what Peter Thiel was writing, and you know, and some of the other like luminaries in the space, like Stan Druckenmiller and other people, and felt like these were the people that really only got the only people that really got it, that understood what was actually happening at the time, not even like in the future, and that's what I wanted to do. I realized that, and so I went to left Deutsche. I went to SAC Capital. Worked for actually for Dan Tapiero, who's on the show recently. And then spent a couple other years at other hedge funds leading and growing research and investing for kind of managers in that space.
Got it. Dan is fantastic. He came on and gave me the hard pitch on gold and Bitcoin both. So he definitely is great. So after you did that, you eventually end up teaming up with a partner and you start Row. Tell us a little bit about just what the impetus for the idea was.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty simple at the time. It's gotten more complex, but it was really that you know, that fintech had been going after the very bottom of the market for a very long time. It's basically since fintech had started. If you think about fintech kind of starting in 2010, you know, primarily on the consumer side, it was like companies like Chime that went after, you know, the lowest end of consumers. And on the business side too, it was companies like, you know, all like the lending networks that serve businesses were generally going after like very small kind of mom and pop type businesses. And I think there's just this assumption in the market that if a company is big, whether they've raised venture capital or they have a lot of people, they have some sort of operational complexity, that because they're a good client of the bank, they're generally happy. The bank is, you know, is taking care of them. And that was something that we thought was just fundamentally wrong. We thought that actually like the companies, the bigger they were, actually like the more problems they had, the more complexity they had, the harder it was to be like really good at servicing them and the more technology that they needed to do better. That was sort of my top down, you know, 30,000 foot view. I came in from as a like investor type, and my partner, Alex, who I teamed up with, was an operator. He was chief product officer at a company called List, which has, you know, a couple hundred people between New York and London. And it scaled a couple other companies in the past. And he would hit these growing pains every time he came into a company and, you know, took it from 30 to, you know, 100, 200 people. So our perspective was that we can fix that and that this is like actually the best way to, you know, go into this market that's $120 billion market that is pretty commoditized but has like a lot of room for growth if you can like move past the basic product.
Got it. And so talk a little bit about as you guys have started building the business, it seems like you've got a ton of different kind of product lines and have really built out a pretty compelling you know, solution for these types of high growth businesses. What does that look like in practice in terms of the various touch points you have with the customer?
Yeah. I mean, so we started out just building the basic like banking sort of core infrastructure, right? Checking account, we have a treasury management product and a card product. Those are kind of like the building blocks for everything else that came after that. And then we started going past. So like building a comprehensive like budgeting platform that allows companies to set, you know, quarterly annual budgets for different lines and attribute all their expenses to those, you know, deeper syncing with accounting. That way everything kind of is live real time, user management, accounts payable. Like there's a lot in the product. You know, not every company uses everything, and that's kind of the point. It's meant to be kind of continue to grow with you. But, you know, our perspective is always like that the financial services are, Yeah, they need to be best in class. They need to be priced competitively. But fundamentally, like what matters is like the stuff that actually helps people get their job done every single day. And so that's where we invest all our time. And as we grow, like, you know, we think about what do we add that's adjacent to our product that, you know, CFOs and finance teams are using every single day that's interfacing with banking. And that's where we'll continue to grow. I mean, we just launched accounts payable, which again, it always blew my mind that that was like a separate product to begin with, that a company like Bill.com, for example, could be so big, performing such a, you know, discrete function. So that's kind of where we're headed.
Got it. And why the focus on those high growth businesses? Like there's tons of checking products, there's tons of treasury management products, but like, you're not only differentiating in some of the features and kind of the efficacy of the product, but you're also specifically focusing on a certain part of the market. So like, how do you think about that market?
I mean, what we thought very early on was like, the market does not need another checking account, right? The market does not need another bank account. Yeah, you can do low fees and all that stuff. That's been done 100 times. Not to say that someone won't make money doing that, but that wasn't the game we wanted to play. You know, what the market did need was like, companies need help as they grow. And they need help from a personal level, and they need help from a technology level. And banks weren't automatically overnight going to become great at building technology and software. Like, they're not, right? Like, most of the software that you buy from a bank, or the software that you rent from a bank, I guess, is like FIS or Fiserv, right? It's built by like one of the core companies. It's not even built by the bank. So we're not really competing with them on that level at all. We don't feel like we really compete with anybody on the software level. We compete with banks on the product level, but we're, you know, generally better priced than them to begin with. That's sort of how we, you know, what we try to build in terms of like thinking about high growth customers and why we go towards them. It's actually more that they come towards us. We're open to anybody. But like, I would say like, we're not the best option if you're a company that's just getting started and you need a basic checking account. Tons of people that can do that for you. As you start to get bigger and bigger and have more people and more complexity and need an all-in-one solution, like, that's where we're the best. And that's where we will stand against anybody in the market and win. And so that's sort of how we got there. It's not, we don't have an industry specific vertical. We're not like banking for startups or banking for e-com or banking for, you know, like marketing or banking for plumbers, like whatever. You know, there's this big thesis out there that like, there's going to be all these banking for companies. I strongly reject that. I think it's way too hard to build. I think it's really hard to be really excellent at this. And I don't think there are going to be 1,000 companies that are excellent at it.
Yeah. And help me understand, like, if I'm a startup founder, you know, I start out, there's 2 or 3 folks on my team. We start building, we hit this kind of inflection point, we start to scale. Is it difficult to get folks to kind of transition from whatever their original banking service was to you? And kind of, how do you think about, is it a somebody who doesn't appear to be a competitor because they're just so far, in a different part of the market, can they basically entrench themselves and make your job harder? Or how do you kind of convince people to basically, abandon the solution they started with and really move to you guys?
It's one of those things that it's actually not as hard as it sounds. People do build it up. They're like, like switching banks is such a pain. Like, and it's, you know, it's like, if you're big, it's like an hour of work. And if you're small, it's like 20 minutes. It's really not that bad. We have a team that is here to actually help them transition. So, if companies come to us and they want help moving all their stuff, we'll do it for them. It's a pretty open ecosystem. Banking is in a lot of ways very low tech. It's not that bad, but it is like something that people overstate all the time.
Got it. How did COVID-19 and the pandemic, the macro environment, like all the kind of craziness and uncertainty and chaos that happened in 2020, how did that affect your business? Did it accelerate? Was there some obstacles?
It definitely accelerated. I mean, I think in 2 ways, both in terms of, you know, new customer growth and existing customer growth. Like we saw the companies on our platform, some of which, you know, grew 200-300% during the crisis because they were high growth companies to begin with, or companies that understood technology, again, whatever vertical you're in, did pretty well through the crisis. And it was generally companies that were slower, attached more to the physical world, bricks and mortar, stuff like that, that, you know, unfortunately, like had a really tough time. So, it definitely like helped our companies, and our companies have, I think, you know, emerged stronger in the past year than where they were before.
Got it. And then in terms of where you guys go from here, right? What is kind of the product roadmap look like? And how do you kind of see the business evolving?
I mean, I don't want to give too much away in terms of product roadmap because I know our competitors watch everything we do these days.
Tell us all the secrets. Come on.
But, you know, look, I mean, we're trying to just continue to make like the CFO's life simpler, the company's life and the employees' life simpler, and work better together with money. That's our mission statement. That's our ethos, is helping people work better together with money. And so we will continue to build product, you know, where there's this fragmented, verticalized ecosystem where CFOs generally have to juggle between 7 and 10 products. Like, we want to make that ultimately one or two. And so we will just continue to move down that line at a measured pace and try to, again, just add value to our customers and bring the ecosystem together. You know, there's the Ben Horowitz or Rick Andreessen, I forget which one of them, quote, right? But that everything is either bundling or rebundling, unbundling or rebundling. We're very much in the rebundling business and believe that the time is now for that. You know, I think it's all everything about startups and about, especially about that, is about timing. So we'll keep rebundling.
Got it. You mentioned CFOs, and it's interesting that you specifically target one person in the executive team of these companies, and you kind of know, hey, look, that's the person that we're trying to make their life easier. Talk a little bit about them as customers. Like, what are some of the things that maybe you guys understand that would be surprising to people who don't spend all day thinking about, you know, making a CFO's life easier? Are there certain complexities or obstacles that they deal with that were surprising, or maybe some, you know, anecdotes in terms of things that CFOs have said to you in the past that, you know, really kind of seared in your brain and you guys remember?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for us, like, our customers, the whole company, like, it is, you know, from the employees all the way up to the CEO, but the CFO is really the decision maker and the buyer for us. And he's the one that's, you know, that's evaluating all the service providers and choosing Row versus others. I think there's two things that really like that motivate, you know, that person, when it comes to this particular space. One is like, they understand that like no product is perfect, and that like, and that having like a level of support, and a person behind that is incredibly valuable. There was a really dumb banker saying that like when met with this like, you know, like $50 billion bank in the Midwest, when we were like looking for our partner bank, they were like, yeah, CFOs just want one neck to strangle. Just like a really off color, odd, I guess, you know, old school banking thing. I haven't been in the banking world for very long, but it's kind of true. You know, they want that person. Because it's never going to be perfect, or they're always going to have questions, or there's always edge cases. Banking is always a game of edge case. So that's one. Two is like, you know, every company is a little bit different, and being able to allow them to set up their integrations, the way they run their accounting, you know, the way that they do budgeting, like all that stuff. There's no, we kind of started out with this is the way it should be. And that's kind of like a great ethos from a product manager perspective, right? Like, don't try to give the customer too many choices. That's not true in this world. You want as much flexibility as possible, because every one of these customers looks a little bit different, and we're not going to ask them to change the way that they operate.
Got it. And are you able to do anything in terms of, once you have a business on as a customer, you pretty much have access to, you know, incredible data. You understand who's growing, who's not growing. But really what you have is you've got an ecosystem of customers. And do you guys do anything with, you know, kind of putting customers together or leveraging the growing customer base you have? Like, how do you think about the customers in a kind of totality of the actual customer base? Is there anything there that you guys have done?
Yeah, I mean, we'll continue to like productize that more, but we try to put our customers in specific verticals together with, you know, the same account representatives. And he's able to connect them all the time and connect them, you know, if he's covering e-commerce or another one's covering, you know, specific areas in venture, being able to connect them with each other, connect them with investors like that are, you know, also on our platform. So there's a, you know, similar to like, I guess what some of the, like, the more established banks will do, you know, for some of their clients, we embrace that as well. And so that is, you know, that is where we are today. I think as we grow, like we'll look to add more technology around that, and ultimately like formalize that. But today it is an incredible collective of like super high growth, super interesting companies that are doing cool stuff. And they generally want to know each other. So we're happy to facilitate that.
Got it. Makes sense. What's been the most surprising thing, since you started the business?
I think the most surprising thing has been like, I guess the most surprising thing or for me, coming from like a non-tech background, has been just like the product development cycle. And the fact that like you know, there's truly like no shortcut. Like it is time times people, add more people. You can do it faster, take the same amount of people, do it slower. But that is it. And so you need to be like really disciplined and parsimonious in terms of your choices, about what you're going to build. Thankfully I have like an amazing product manager as a partner who, has taught me that lesson over and over again. Otherwise it would have been harder, but yeah, that's been like kind of the most interesting thing I think for me coming from the other side of the universe.
Got it. And then what's been the one thing that maybe you've really said, hey, we want to accomplish X, but you guys haven't been able to do it yet. Whether it's just, we're not there yet in terms of building the product. There's some other limitation, maybe even regulation or whatever it is. Is there something that sticks out in terms of you guys are almost chasing it, but haven't yet done it?
I mean, there hasn't been much. Like we've always like said, I guess what this is yet another thing that's been surprising is like that there's kind of nothing that you can't do. Like we would always start with something like that and then work backwards and find a way to do it, whether it's through a partnership or on our own. It's just more that you can't do everything all at once. But we haven't found anything that it's like, man, I wish we could do this thing that JP Morgan can do. It really is just a function of time. I think for us, it's like, we want to be, we want to be a multi-billion dollar institution. We think we'll be there by the end of this year. And that is like what we're chasing today.
Got it. It makes a ton of sense. Bitcoin, crypto, blockchain, kind of this whole decentralized digital world is now getting tons and tons of attention. You guys being in financial services is, somewhat tangentially related. How do you think about that space? And are you guys doing anything there or will you do it something in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we started out building a lot of decentralized tech on our ledger. We ended up like using parts of it, but not all of it, and went a more traditional approach at the beginning. But it's definitely something that both myself and my co-founder were super enmeshed in at the start. In terms of like the space, we're always looking at DeFi. And is there an opportunity to be able to, bring our customers into that? I would say like there's still like fundamental challenges that make that like tough at the moment. But we expect that will change as like, as you have more of an ecosystem and you can basically borrow from those markets in a USD. Like you can't kind of, you have an asset liability mismatch if you're borrowing crypto and your liabilities are in dollars. In terms of other stuff, in terms of Bitcoin, I was a macro analyst and PM for a long time, and I was always the smarter guys that I worked for would always tell me to like focus on the supply side of any market because it's the most predictable. Whether you're looking at oil, whether you're looking at like stocks, whether you're looking at, like you can actually like solve backwards from like supply, and that will generally give you like a pretty good indication of like where market's going to go. So like in a lot of ways, like I mean, crypto and like Bitcoin is like kind of like the perfect market. It's the perfect like because like you do have like a fundamentally locked supply that's going to decline. I remember looking at it, and I feel dumb for not buying more of it. In 2011 or 2013, and I was like. I was like, this is like the perfect bubble in a lot of ways, because it is like, literally you couldn't construct something that would like, this is exactly what we would look for. Basically, this is exactly what I would look for as an analyst in a market, like where's a market where supply is going down and where there's like, there's inherent demand that's growing. And it's like really that simple. So I think it's, the market, it's super volatile. It'll move every day and, it might go up or down 30%, but like it has, the right characteristics.
Absolutely. And it's pretty incredible. I think that, it is that simple, right? It's just from a market structure standpoint, like the supply goes down, 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 and there's a caps overall supply. And then you get a increasing demand. And like, if you took an economics 101 course, you know what happens next, right? And it's all price gets up. Like, it's not rocket science.
No, it's pretty simple. I mean, the other thing is like markets are made at the margin, right? So it doesn't take that much buying to move it. Like, I think, you know, yes, it's a, what I don't know what it is right now, $1 trillion market cap or whatever it is, but you know, how much is actually moving every day and settling at the end of the day, not just like trading intraday. It's not just like any market. It doesn't take that much to move it.
Absolutely. Talk a little bit about kind of the decentralized finance movement, right? So, you know, whether it's being built on Bitcoin or Ethereum or wherever, just this idea of like, let's build these decentralized applications that replace a lot of the same financial service or banking functions. Have you guys looked at that or kind of what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, we've looked at it. I think, you know, I think there's a really bright future there. Again, I think our perspective on the space was that the ecosystem was, look, that the challenge is really building an audience. It is really building like, you know, a community of businesses and providing value. And I think that fundamentally as a borrower, which most of our businesses would be in this instance, you know, they shouldn't really care. Is it, you know, like they need to be able to grow their business. That's what they care about. They're not there to make, you know, bets on crypto. They're not there to like, to do sort of stuff in DeFi. They just want a better product. And so our perspective has always been like, if it gives our customer a lower cost of interest, if it gives our customer a better borrowing experience, you know, we will embrace it. I would say today, like it's still far off, but it's not, but it's moving very fast to the point where I think that there's a real opportunity there. And like so much of credit and of you know, of finance is so manual and is so old school that, you know, I'm really excited about a lot of the developments in that space because I think that they will accelerate, you know, the adoption of credit and for a lot of these customers.
Absolutely. That makes a ton of sense. What's the one big thing that you guys are looking forward to in 2021? You mentioned kind of trying to accomplish a multi-billion dollar, you know, kind of institutional evaluation or milestone, but what's the big thing that gets you guys there?
Yeah, I mean, like multi-billion in terms of like the assets of our clients on our platform, and I think we'll be there pretty fast. Like what gets us there is like just continuing to put our heads down and execute. Honestly, I mean, we spent 2 years, you know, with like really no product, with no market, focusing on product before we launched. You know, we think very firmly the best product in the market wins. We've done like basically no marketing. Like we really are, you know, focused on learning from our customers, growing around them, and building out that way. So, you know, there's a lot of other people that are, you know, doing a lot of hand waving and putting billboards everywhere, whatever. We're not about that. Like we're really just trying to focus and win.
Got it. We didn't talk about the name. Where did Roe come from?
So Roe is like the DVO1 of an option, right? It's like, if interest rates go up by X percent, what is my option worth? And it was kind of a metaphor for like how we try to help our customers, right? It's like, we're going to improve your trajectory a little bit, not a ton, like that's up to you, but you know, enough. And so that's sort of where it came from.
I love that.
Thanks.
In terms of the fintech space in general, it seems like everyone is SPACing, going public, raising monster rounds, like just the interest from the public markets and kind of large late stage growth investors is off the charts. Is that something that's kind of a bubble or frothy and like, yeah, there's a point in time where this all is fun and games, but like it's getting out of hand? Or do you guys feel like, no, you know, investors have it right and kind of digital, you know, businesses that focus on the finance industry are really just getting started? And I'm cheating because asking somebody who's building a company in the space is probably a little biased, but how do you think about that?
I mean, I am for sure. I'm a little biased because I made that, you know, this is the bet that I made with my career. I had the same conversation 2 years ago with our investors. They're like, this is a bubble, you know, so, you know, valuation should be here, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, it's a new asset class. It's not a bubble. Like venture, you know, at the time was $500 billion versus like PE, which was like 2 billion. Now it's like a billion versus 2 billion. Trillion versus 2 trillion. I absolutely don't think it's a bubble. I think that there's two things that are happening. One, interest rates are zero, right? real rates are negative, that means future value equals present value for all intents and purposes. So find something that's going to grow. Like, it should be worth a lot today, even if they're not making that much money today. If interest rates go back up, which is like a very big if, like that will change a bit. But like, that is appropriately priced for where we are today in the cycle, and investors should understand that. I think the second thing is that it has never been possible in history, at least as far as I know, to build companies from the ground up that, you know, can compete with, you know, $50-100 billion companies that exist in public markets today. And as an investor, you know, would I rather put $1 billion into Stripe or whatever the new Stripe is, or like, you know, Thesis, or, you know, one of these like Worldpay or someone like that, right? Like, I would much, I can guarantee you it's going to be more valuable in an earlier stage company that can replicate, you know, what exists today in public markets than what exists in public markets. And private markets are only about 6% of public markets overall, right? If you think about total market cap globally. So no, I think it's a new reality. And I think that it is like, you know, comparisons to the previous bubble are pretty misplaced. It's a new asset class.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And I think also the thing that people are underestimating and maybe, you know, kind of just completely missing is the global nature of this. And also just how much more efficient, how much more profitable, how much more scalable the digital versions are, right? Or kind of these like new age technologies. And some of it's literally like you're a digital business and the competitor you have is a digital business, but you're using technologies that are far superior and therefore more scalable, more efficient, you know, kind of more valuable to the customer. And in some cases, literally you're going up against a bank that sells a fax machine, right? Like it really is kind of all over the place, but it seems like you guys really have an advantage from the position you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that there's so much, there's opportunity everywhere, you know, not just in the space we're doing and consumer and like all over fintech. Like, I don't think, you know, the top five banks have been the top five banks for the past 30 years, literally. I think the next 20 years, like that will not be the case. Like, it will be someone like us, someone like Chime, that will be up there.
Yeah, I love that. Before I finish up, I always ask everyone the same three questions and you'll get to ask me one to finish up. The first one is more serious. What's the most important book that you've ever read?
That's a good question. I think the most impactful book I ever read was a book called The Inner Game of Tennis.
What is that?
So it was written in, I think, like 1979 or something like that. And it was, but it's about a 100-page book. It's pretty short. And it's really about like embracing a performance mindset. I was given to me when I like started trading from another PM, and it was it's a great book. It's a great book for no matter what you're doing, but especially if you're in a performance driven job where you really have to, you know, learn how to like focus on your your insights and instincts and sort of quiet like the sort of part of your mind that is fighting that. Because that's where like, you know, if you're playing tennis, okay, like you just have to go flow. But if you're doing anything else, right, if you're running a portfolio, like you have insights that other people don't see. And those are hard to kind of get at. Like your brain is constantly telling you, you know, no, like, and you have to unlock that a little bit. Or if you're building a company, same thing. Like, so I thought that was a really good one. I've read it about four times. I should probably read it again. But yeah.
I love that. I've never heard of that book, so I'll definitely check it out. Next one's a little bit more personal. And this is a question sponsored by 8Sleep, which has got this kind of cooled mattress. Matteo, the CEO, got on me and said, "Hey, man, you got to start sleeping more. Use this thing." And all of a sudden, now I feel like I'm sleeping on an ice block, but I get deeper REM sleep. And it pretty much changed the way that awesome. I feel during the day. How do you sleep? Are you a 4 or 5 hour person? Are you a 10 hour person? What's kind of your sleep routine?
I have a 2-year-old daughter, so my sleep routine has changed a lot in the past couple of years. I'm basically, my sleep revolves around her, basically. So when she goes to bed, I try to get to bed, and then she wakes up earlier than me and it's like hitting me on the head, you know, whatever, 6 a.m.
I recently started asking this question, and so I don't have a ton of data points, but every single person with a kid under the age of 3 years old makes sure that is a known part of the change in the sleep routine. So
it's a big change.
The young child is now the boss, it seems like.
Totally.
Absolutely. And then my final question before you get to ask me one is more fun, which is aliens. Are you a believer or a non-believer?
Can I be in the middle? Like, I wouldn't, I think there's like a decent chance, but I, you know, it's not a belief or non-belief thing. It's a probability. I think it's a non-zero probability.
Okay. And if you're in the middle, I'm going to assume you're similar to me of like, yes, there, it's highly probable that just given how big the universe is, it, you know, there's some form of intelligent life, but they're not little green men that visited Earth type thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. The universe is pretty big. So there's probably something out there, most likely, mathematically. But, you know, they probably haven't been here. We probably haven't been there. But I don't know. There's a lot. Yeah, you got to ask smarter people that one. That's over my pay grade.
There's a guy in, I think he's from Israel. He was like in charge of, you know, extraterrestrial search in Israel or whatever. And now he's come out, he's older, and he's claiming that there's like a galactic federation and all the planets are all part of it. And I was like,
really?
I was like, you might have stared in telescopes for too long or something.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. You got to get Elon Musk on the show and ask him that.
He's, absolutely. You could ask me one question to finish up. What do you got for me?
All right. Well, what do you think? I mean, look, you know, it's been a crazy world for crypto. Like, are we overhyped at this point? Is this just the beginning of, you know, the next wave? You know, where do you think, how do you think we shape out here?
Yeah. So I think that, I have three separate thoughts that are all related. One is, we are at the start of what I'll call like the institutional bull market. So kind of last two or three bull markets have really been retail driven. This is really the first institutional bull market. So it's got room to run from like a price standpoint, how high it goes, how long it lasts. You know, that, again, people much smarter than me will figure that out. But just like, hey, the institutions are now here. They're buying Bitcoin. They're starting to look at the space. Like, they're taking this much more seriously than they ever have. And I think that only gets more pervasive and more significant over time. Two is everyone is probably drastically underestimating how important and big just this general move is. So you know, I basically think of it in two different frameworks. So one is like the digital version of all of these businesses is going to be way bigger than the current iteration. And if you really think, like, I think a lot of people compare digital to analog. I always talk about there's almost this like middle step where it was like analog that went to really electronic, like with electronic QSIPs. And so there was some, you know, computer enabled type transactions. But if you look at like the technology you're using versus some of these legacy banks, like, you guys are really digital. Those banks are more kind of electronic QSIP. And so it's better than analog, but like, there was still some bureaucracy and some pain points and middlemen and all that that you guys are removing. So I think that like digital will be bigger than kind of electronic or analog. The other thing is that I think that the decentralized protocols will be bigger than their centralized counterparts. Some of that will be like protocol versus company. Some of that will just be decentralized protocol versus centralized product, whatever it ends up being. I think it's a ways out, like maybe, you know, we're like 5 years away from that, like really being you know, kind of pervasive. And so if you really start to look at that as like, okay, I want to be in digital finance and I eventually want to be in digital decentralized finance, Bitcoin's probably the only thing that really kind of hits that spot right now. It's had this incredible run. But like, when you look at how big is that market, like, most people are talking about like, you know, does Bitcoin go to 100K? I'm thinking like, Bitcoin's $100 trillion market cap at some point in the future. And again, I don't know if that's 50 years from now, right? Or 20,
right?
But it's not tomorrow, right? You know what I mean? Like, like, it's pretty far away. And so then you get into this world of like, well, okay, if that's just like the core unit of account, well then like, what's all the other value that gets created? Like the decentralized infrastructure, decentralized lending, like all of that's going to happen. It's just hard to tell like who builds it and how long it takes. And then the last thing I think is, it's not a straight line. So you kind of have like, yes, we're in an institutional bull market. Two, we're all underestimating how big this is going to be. But three is like, you know, put your seatbelt on because this is going to be super volatile along the way, right? I mean, you know, you kind of look at the business you guys have built. There's days where you probably feel euphoric and it's like, we're going to, you know, be the next top five bank. And then there's days where you're like, oh my God, like, you know, the house is on fire, right? And sometimes that may happen in the morning and afternoon in the same day, just given like, you know, the challenges of building a company. So I think that people just have to remember, like, you know, there's going to be price corrections along the way. There's going to be protocols that, you know, fail and kind of all of that type of stuff. And so it's you can be bullish on a really long time horizon, but also be, you know, somewhat patient in the short to medium term and understand like all great things just take time to build. Yeah. So I think that's how I look at it. It doesn't necessarily give us answers. It's like where people should go put their money. But I think it's a framework that kind of, you know, rationally explains like where we go.
That's awesome. That is, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Where can we send people to find you on the internet or find out more about Roe?
Yeah. So you can come see us at roho.co. And if you're a company or you're CFO or just want to learn more, you can book an appointment with one of our team members. You can find me on Twitter at Everett Cook NY. I'm not very active though. We're also at Roe Business Banking. Roe Business on Twitter.
We got to get you on Twitter and tweeting, man.
I've been following you for a while, actually.
I'm expecting now for you to just start with a couple of hot takes after we do this podcast.
And, all right, you got it. You can retweet if I say anything smart.
Yeah, I'll retweet it. My 2-year-old keeps me awake at night, and you'll be the most popular guy.
That's right.
Because every young parent will agree. Awesome, cool. Man. Listen, thank you so much, Everett. I really appreciate this, and I think that people will have learned a lot, but also two. I think you just sitting at a really interesting intersection between a bunch of different disciplines, and obviously the business you guys built is fantastic. So I highly suggest people go check it out, roe.co, or go find you on Twitter.
Awesome.